expressed advisory as established by the Department of Homeland Security is warranted.
Whatever the seatbelt sign is on, your seatbelt should be fastened.
Ladies and gentlemen, please observe as I point out the features of our safety briefing card, seatbelt, and oxygen mask.
Welcome to Vagabonding with Kids by A.K. Turner. I'm a New York Times bestselling author with a husband and two young daughters. We travel about 4 months of every year to live and work as digital nomads from various locations around the globe. You can find more information at vagabondingwithkids.com, along with a free download of a 68-page freedom travel guide that tells you how we manage work, school, family, and finances while traveling the world. This podcast is an audio recording of the Vagabonding with Kids book series. Chapter 1, Becoming Vagabonds. Vagabonding is not a lifestyle, nor is it a trend. It's just an uncommon way of looking at life, a value adjustment from which action naturally follows. Rolf Potts, Vagabonding. I'm sorry, but her eyes have to be open, the clerk said. I was in a drugstore attempting to have Amelia's passport photo taken. She was 2 weeks old. Come on, baby, I said, jiggling and prodding her to return to consciousness while propping her upright but trying to stay out of the shot myself. This required holding 10 squishy, sleeping pounds up over my head and away from my body, which is no easy feat. My arms strained and my armpits began to sweat. Was that moisture I felt, seeping from her diaper? Would a stream of urine, or worse, begin snaking its way down my arm? Everything will be okay, I told myself, as long as you don't drop the baby. The clerk smiled nervously, caught between amusement at the situation and what looked like suspicion, as if procuring a passport for a newborn indicated nefarious purposes on my part. Perhaps I was trying to kidnap the child or exploiting her to gain inside knowledge for a business in passport counterfeiting. Whatever his concerns, he put them aside. It took 5 minutes until he was able to snap a photo during a weak flutter of eyelids. Just a few years before, I looked at travelers with small children with a similar curiosity. There could be no good reason for taking a child on a plane all the way from Los Angeles to Sydney, Australia, for instance. And as we made that flight, childless and for the first time, I assumed that all of my fellow travelers with children must be in the process of moving their permanent residence from the United States to Australia, because I could see no other motive that would make such an undertaking of 15 hours on a plane with a child worth it. Mike, I pretended not to notice that my husband was sleeping during the aforementioned flight and elbowed him awake. Yeah? Did you know that when we get to Sydney, we have a 14-hour layover? Yeah, he mumbled. What are we going to do for 14 hours? We'll go see the stuff there. The stuff there? Yeah, the stuff that's there to see. We'll go see that. Yes, but 14 hours? We might have to rent a room or something. This perked him up, as if my motivation for renting a room had to do with anything other than a solid nap. Seriously, Mike, 14 hours is a long time. What are we going to do with ourselves? Don't worry, Amanda, he assured me. We'll tackle that stone when we cross it. I let him drift back to sleep while I pondered the combination of words he'd put together and pictured him determinedly wrestling a series of immovable boulders. When we reached Sydney, we paid a baggage service to secure our luggage while we ventured out of the airport. In other words, we handed over cash for someone to take our suitcases into a private room, rifle through them, and pocket our valuables. We would later find that a Leatherman tool I'd bought Mike for his birthday was missing, and in return we ended up with someone else's toiletry bag. When I discovered the bag, I was sure it would have wildly exciting contents, like drugs, a roll of $100 bills, and a revolver. But the toiletry bag was disappointingly filled with toiletries. Not only are a stranger's nail clippers and razors less than dramatic, but also kind of gross. Unaware of the theft that was occurring, we took a train from the Circular Quay, window-shopped, strolled around the harbor, and eventually made our way to a park bench whose hard wooden slats beckoned to us. It wasn't as comfortable as the hotel room about which my husband and I had very different fantasies, but it was free. We napped on and off for the remaining hours of our monstrous layover until making our way back to the airport for the final leg of our journey. Our destination was a Y-shaped archipelago of more than 80 small islands in the South Pacific known as Vanuatu. We were headed for the capital city of Port Vila on the island of Efate. The previous year saw us living in England, Morocco, and Spain, with smaller side trips to Italy, Greece, France, the Czech Republic, and Mexico. We'd fallen into the nomadic lifestyle by chance. After college, Mike landed what was supposed to be a dream job. It paid well and came with a company car. Living on ramen noodles and struggling to make rent payments for years came to an end, and the combination of money, wheels, and a gas station credit card seemed like answered prayers. But in the year that followed, I watched my husband's elation give way to encroaching resentment. The commute was brutal, the work was depressing, and the hours never ended. When his first annual review approached, a small spark came back into his eyes. "I know what I'm going to say at my review," he announced. "They're going to offer me a raise, but I'm going to tell them I don't want a raise." "Wait, you don't want a raise?" "No, I want more time off. I'm going to ask for an extra week of vacation time instead." The day of his review, he came home more depressed than ever. "Did you get the extra week of vacation time?" I asked, though his demeanor told me the answer. "No," he said. "They said no. They gave me a raise." I hadn't thought it possible for someone to look so sad while communicating that he'd received a pay increase. Mike settled into a state of dissatisfaction and routine, and then he received the phone call that would rearrange our lives. A friend from college wanted to employ my husband in the movie business, and it would require us to live and work at different film locations around the world. He gleefully quit the corporate dream job, and in the 15 years since, he has not once lamented the loss of money or job stability. As Air Vanuatu carried us closer to tropical forests and active volcanoes, I pressed my head to the window. "It looks pretty amazing," I said to Mike. "It looks awesome," he agreed. The plane began a slight descent, and a baby howled. The mother tried to shush and rock her child back into complacency to no avail. Minutes went by, and the air grew tense as passengers waited for silence. We glanced at the mother with a combination of sympathy, pity, and annoyance. The crying increased. The mother unbuckled her seatbelt to stand so that she might better rock the baby, but a flight attendant quickly instructed her to sit back down. "We are not doing that," I said. "Doing what?" Mike asked. "Taking kids on long trips?" "Hell no," he agreed. "That sounds like a terrible idea. We'd never get first-class upgrades. We couldn't drink in airport bars." "And that's the only thing that makes airports redeemable," I said. "We'll travel with our kids when they're older, like when they're teenagers. If we even have kids," I added. In Port Vila, we disembarked, and a group of locals, clad in matching shirts with bright tropical prints, welcomed us on the runway, singing and playing ukuleles. Vanuatu is an endearing place to be, where the language has a lilting cadence and everyone carries a machete. To this day, I believe the Nivan to be the friendliest people on earth. I spent my 3 months there making endless trips from one side of Efate to the other in a beat-up pickup truck, into which I welcomed many a machete-wielding stranger who might otherwise spend hours hacking his way through the jungle in an effort to get home to his family after a long day of work. On many occasions, the people I offered rides to declined, explaining that they were not going to or from work, but rather training for an annual race that leads runners on a series of roads circling the island. At least half of the competitors I witnessed, either in training or on the day of the race, ran barefoot. Others donned flip-flops, and a select few sported sneakers. The surface underneath them changed from hard-packed dirt to pavement to loose gravel, and the runners, of both sexes and varying ages, never seemed to notice. I can't walk to my mailbox barefoot. Eventually, I learned to spot runners as opposed to commuters, because long-distance runners were never armed with machetes. As a result, I learned to offer rides only to machete-wielding strangers. My job in Vanuatu involved scouring the island for hardware needed at the work site, which is more difficult than it sounds with nary a Home Depot to be found. I also ran errands and drove other employees to various locations. Pigs were as common as machetes and just as valuable. One of the locals with whom we worked desperately wanted to marry his girlfriend, but explained that he did not yet have enough pigs to present to his would-be father-in-law. One day, I drove yet another local worker, John Bosco, to his home in the Black Sands Village. John Bosco was a gem. Hard-working, intelligent, and a genuinely nice man, he was skilled in more areas than anyone I've ever known. Not only had he mastered a multitude of trades, like welding and carpentry, but he was also known to emerge from the jungle having caught, barehanded, a pair of wild chickens. "Amanda," he said when we neared his home, "do you want to meet Bull Macau?" Okay, I replied, not knowing who Bull Macau was, but feeling like I should. "Wait until you see Bull Macau," John Bosco smiled. "I think you will like him." In a large pen, littered with trash and debris, lived a giant pig. He reminded me, size-wise, of a Volkswagen I'd once owned. I approached the beast, who seemed to be weighing in his mind how much he wanted to move away from me versus how much energy the act would require. "Normally we raise the pigs and then eat them," John Bosco explained, "but Bull Macau got so fat that now he is too much fat and not enough meat, so now he is our pet." This is the only time in my life when I encountered a creature whose obesity was beneficial. "Hi," I whispered to Bull Macau and crouched closer. He grunted and lifted to his front hooves, though it looked like lifting to his hind legs as well would be too much for him. "It's okay," I said. We stared at each other for a minute or two before I left. I wanted to stay and scratch his belly and make him love me, but I only made him uncomfortable, I could tell, so I retreated slowly. Meeting Bull Macau was one of those strange moments in life when, staring into the eyes of a 500-pound swine on a volcanic archipelago in the South Pacific, makes you understand that exploring the world isn't something you want to outgrow. Ever. Our 2 years around the world came to an end. We settled into a home and self-employment in Idaho, traveling whenever we could, but on a smaller scale. As we inched ever closer to parenthood, people told us about all the things we would have to give up once we had a child, travel being chief among them. I thought often of the mother and her crying baby en route from Sydney to Vanuatu. The flight had been uncomfortable, surely for the mother more than anyone else, but aren't all flights uncomfortable? As long as the plane lands, I consider the flight a success. Perhaps we'd travel differently with children, but I didn't think giving it up entirely was possible. Our trips with children were limited at first. We tackled the procurement of passports for a newborn who refused to open her eyes on command, and quickly moved on to the challenges of changing a soiled diaper on the floor of a commuter plane. The extent to which the diaper was soiled determined whether or not we referred to the event as a code yellow or the much more dreaded code brown. Those were uncomfortable situations, but nothing that merited foregoing a trip. We learned that jet lag isn't a problem for babies who are accustomed to periodic napping and overcome even the most drastic of time changes in a mere 24 hours. We found ourselves paying extortionist rates for packs of baby wipes in rural areas, but always with gratitude that baby wipes were available, no matter the price. Traveling with infants and toddlers shaped us into far more adaptable parents than we'd have been if we'd remained within the familiarity of our hometown. By the time we shed strollers and diaper bags, it became clear that our children were not only capable when it came to travel, but they also benefited from it. Before a 2-month trip to Australia, Emilia, who'd long since outgrown her sleepy newborn passport, struggled to make friends in her second grade class. She had an awkward and tentative approach when it came to interacting with her peers. During our time abroad, she developed confidence, inquisitiveness, and unrestrained kindness. and upon her return to second grade in the U.S., she regaled her classmates with tales of kangaroos and her dramatic survival of a jellyfish sting. Her awkwardness, for which I claim full responsibility, may remain in part, but there is nothing tentative about her. Our children were more adaptable and accepting than we'd given them credit for. They made friends the world over, learning that language barriers are easily overcome with smiles and imagination. They emerged into travelers who do not balk at 14-hour flights and unfamiliar insects. In the absence of toys, they created imaginary worlds where fallen mangoes are precious gems to be collected. Without the comforts of home, they found adventure in the most unsavory hotel rooms, drawing treasure maps for each other, forcing the explorer to navigate through towering palm trees, bath towels, around a grumpy troll, mini fridge, to reach the lost city of rainbows, a bed. Emboldened by their adaptability, which expanded our own willingness to venture, the locations of our trips stretched farther from home, and their durations dominated more of the calendar. By the time our children were 3 and 5, we had eased into a state of part-time vagabonding, committing to living and working in a different country for an average of 3 months a year. We were unintentional vagabonds before kids, and after a brief respite, our kids proved to us that this approach to life was not only possible for our family of four, but also the most appropriate one for us. Most of the people we encounter show support for, and sometimes envy of, our commitment to extended travel with our children. But occasionally we meet people who assure us that our choices in life are terrible decisions. Each trip we take affirms that it is never wise to pay much attention to those who advise, "You just can't do that. It'll never work." Possibility has nothing to do with convention, and there have been times when I've almost let the latter get in the way of the former, or momentarily listened to the naysayers. We're firmly on the other side of those doubts and obstacles now, committed to how we live and move about the world. To many, getting to this point seems like a difficult journey in itself, but for me, making the move to our current life most resembles Amelia struggling for that first passport photo. I just needed to open my eyes. Thank you for listening to Vagabonding with Kids. If you enjoy this series, please share it with others. Connect with me at vagabondingwithkids.com, and from there you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. If you enjoy the book, feel free to review it on Goodreads, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, or in a blog or a Facebook post. That's all for now. Don't forget to download your free freedom travel guide at vagabondingwithkids.com. Let me come home.